I'm Terry Thornton. I'm Curator of Education. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. Tuesday Evenings is an ongoing lecture series that I'm quite proud of and has a very faithful following. We have 10 lectures in the fall and 10 in the spring, and We are about halfway through, and it has been an amazing series. Anybody who's been here regularly, I think, would concur. Last week, we had Jill Maggott here, and she was really interesting. I also, if you don't know, we do podcasts approximately 2 weeks after each of the lectures, and I would really recommend you go back and listen to Jill's and determine if you think she's lying to you. Next week, we're going to take our spring break, but we will return on the 27th with the always intriguing artist and writer Andrea Frazier, who was here about, I think my calculations are right, about 8 years back to present her own work, and she is returning to present an enormously compelling, and I am not exaggerating, essay on the phenomenon of crying in response to the work of Fred Sandbach, aptly titled, Why Does Fred Sandbach's Work Make Me Cry? It was written for Dia Beacon, and it really is a beautiful essay and such an interesting concept that she pursues through that essay. So I invite you back. We discussed that essay actually when Andrea was here before, and upon reading it, I knew that as soon as enough time had passed that I could get away with it, I would be asking her back. And so the time has come, and I highly recommend you being here on the 27th. Again, if you show up next week, we won't be here. But come back on the 27th. However, I'm not positive about this, but if we do have a website, you might want to check and see if the galleries are going to remain open until 7 next week. So it might be a nice, quiet time to come back and visit the Glenn Ligon show or the Permanent Collection or the Katie Patterson Focus Exhibition. Tonight also offers the promise of intrigue and enlightenment. In this case, with the beautiful and conceptually poignant work of artist Byron Kim, I apologize. Byron is here from New York, actually Brooklyn, where he lives and works, and I believe where he has remained since receiving his BA from Yale in 1983. In 1986, he was invited to the Skowhegan School of Painting and Sculpture, where so many accomplished artists have passed through as students and instructors. Since that time, Byron has developed a meaningful career with an impressive exhibition record, works in notable collections, including the Albright Knox, Art Institute of Chicago, the Brooklyn Museum of Art, the Hirshhorn Museum, the Walker, and the Whitney, to name a few. His work has been acknowledged with awards, including the 2008 Alpert Award in Art, a Joan Mitchell Foundation grant, an NEA, a Lewis Comfort Tiffany Award, and in 1994, the Award for the Visual Arts by the Korean Arts Foundation of America. In 1993, Byron's watershed painting, Synecdoche, which is an ongoing painting project, for those of you who are unfamiliar, which is now in the collection of National Gallery of Art, a really interesting thing to collect since it continues to grow. Anyway, this painting was included in that year's Whitney Biennial, and in some ways I think launched Byron's career. He also collaborated with friend and fellow artist Glenn Ligon on Rumble, Young Man Rumble, which was included in Thelma Golden's historical exhibition Black Male, also in 1993 and also at the Whitney. Such work as this has had Byron identified with issues of race, as described in a National Gallery press release, which in fact was for Synecdoche. That's going to be in the podcast. I so regret that. which, you know, each time they acquire, he does more of these paintings than they acquire a new one. And so for the recent press release, They describe the work as exploring the history of abstract painting, the problems of color and vision, and issues of human identity and existence. And then also with Byron, there is the accurate tag of conceptualist and oft-mentioned influence of minimalism. His work was included in the 2003 Whitney exhibition Approaching Objects and the 2004 Specific Objects Minimalist Influence at the Museum of Contemporary Art in San Diego. Other notable exhibitions include the 2006 solo exhibition Threshold, for which we have the catalog in the bookstore if you're interested. Threshold, there we go. The 2006 solo exhibition Threshold that began at UC Berkeley Art Museum and traveled widely from there, as well as the Tate Liverpool's 2009 group exhibition Color Chart, Reinventing Color 1950 to Today, and most recently Time Lapse of Site Santa Fe, which opened in February and runs through May 20th for any of you that are going that direction. And in this intro, I have to report that last fall I had one of those thank God art still is alive and kicking moments when I came across Byron's night sky paintings at the James Cohen Gallery. There's a beautiful catalog for that, which I wish we had in the bookstore, but I really recommend, if you can get your hands on it, to do so. That exhibition really did, honestly, stop me in my tracks. As I assume you will see tonight, these are, to my mind anyway, poetic renditions of the night sky, and they are absolutely mesmerizing. They conjure Byron's much-loved Sunday paintings, as they are about the sky, but they are also complex color studies that remind us of Mark Rothko or maybe even Ed Reinhardt. In addition to being a thoughtful painter, Byron is the kind of thinker who has sought out to speak and write about art as well. His interview with Glenn Ligon, which was for Ligon's first museum survey, is included in Ligon's book, Yourself in the World, which we also have in the bookstore and I've mentioned a few times during the run of the exhibition. He has sat on panels and given talks at the likes of UCLA, the MoMA, the Whitney, the Tate, and the New Museum, somewhat recently, under the title, this apparently is a program they have, A Proposition by Byron Kim, and his was titled A Cosmology of Doubt, which I think is very intriguing. All of this, of course, is to say that we are most fortunate to have Byron with us tonight, so please join me in welcoming Byron Kim.
Well, thanks, Terry, for inviting me, and that was far and away the best introduction I've ever heard. So I'm going to do something slightly different here, which, and I hope will go okay, because one time I remember doing something like this, it just was a disaster. But I once gave a talk at the Hirshhorn. Thankfully, there were only about six people in the audience, and I, for some reason, put a slide of Pollock's work in the middle of the lecture and thought I could speak extemporaneously on Pollock, and I just froze. So here goes about Rothko, and I'm just going to take this position for a moment. This is the Rothko that's in this museum's collection, and I've included it here because Rothko's been a huge influence on me, and in some ways, my encounter with Rothko's work in college probably got me on the road to thinking about becoming an artist myself. But the real reason why I have it here is just to look at it and try to explicate its meaning. It's really hard to know what paintings like this are about. All the New York School painters, they seem to be tackling subject matter that was too large for words. And I think that that Rothko made paintings like this partly or mostly because of that, because, you know, this is something that can be expressed best without words. And so what was it that he was trying to express? I'm not sure. But I know one thing for sure, and it's not... And that it's not that exactly, because that's too big and it's actually too luminous. I just went back to look at the painting because I was worried about saying something about this blank whiteness. It's really actually not so blank. It's an off-white. It's kind of a dirty white. The whole kind of pallor of the painting is much, much dirtier in real life. It's called Light Cloud, Dark Cloud. And so that red is not that vibrant in the actual painting. And the rectangle, the smaller rectangle, which nestles into the red field, is actually quite a bit fleshier than what you see there. And the ground is also fleshier. It's not orange. I mean, it's in that family, but this is clearly orange. And in the real painting, it's not so orange. So again, what's it about? And that Terry's mentioning my lecture called the Cosmology of Doubt is a good segue. Because I think that Rothko was in my mind, the painter that most perfectly embodies John Keats's notion of negative capability, which was, I'm not going to be able to come up with a direct quotation, but basically Keats said that Shakespeare had the strongest negative capability, and it was the ability to kind of hang out in an area of doubt without, as long as possible, without having to reach for some comfort, let's say. And I think Rothko was able to do that best. And I think that when you go back and look at that painting, when you look at the white part, maybe that's where I saw it the most. How do you know that this painting is finished? How do you know why? What is that area about? Maybe I'll just move on from there. This is also hard because I've been doing this dubious thing of moving on from Mark Rothko to my work. So this painting is from a series of a few paintings that I called Mom, that are about my mom's skin color. And it was in the midst of about a decade or so of work where I was mostly an abstract monochrome painter, and I was often simply looking at a color and copying it. Very simple. I gave a lecture yesterday, and someone asked me why I made this kind of work, and one of the reasons was that I can't draw. And so mostly I had been copying color very strictly from observation, but I thought that my mom's skin color, or a mother's skin as a subject matter, was the closest that I would come to this kind of large subject matter that the New York School painters kind of strove after. because to a newborn, an infant, the mother's surface is sort of like the universe to them. And so while I had been making paintings and artwork that of subject matter that was kind of too small for words, the content was too small for words, this was the one subject matter that I thought could be too, that might be too large for words in the way that those 50s painters explored. So these are two 11th or 12th century, 12th century, early 12th century Korean pots. And the glaze on these pots, which were made in a very short period of time, is probably the single, the cultural production that Koreans are most proud of. And so I was lucky to have the opportunity to make paintings for a show at the Hirshhorn, and the process that I went through was to go to another museum, another Smithsonian museum, the Freer, and they allowed me to handle some of these celadon pots and make studies from them. They didn't know that I have a pot that was handed down to me from my parents that had made it in mint condition. It's this beautiful little cup that looks like a teacup, but the handle is of a dragon's head, and it was actually apparently used for wine dregs. And it got to me in my Greenpoint studio in mint condition, 1,000 years old or so, 900, I guess, years old, and I dropped it. And so I never told the people at the Freer that I had done that. This is the painting that I made from that pot. It seems like such a horrible story, but actually in the end it's a nice story for me because I was so upset when that happened, and I was really nervous, and I called my father, and he said, Don't worry about it. I'm just so relieved that you're okay. And it's just a material thing. It was kind of an amazing thing for him to say. Wow, this is a very bad reproduction of the installation of the paintings at the Hirshhorn. So I included that one painting and then 10 from that were produced from these objects that I looked at the Freer. And the funny thing is that when I finally got to see them all in one space like this and see them all at once, they're very richly layered, although you couldn't tell from this photograph. But the first thought that came to mind wasn't Rothko or Bryce Marden, it was Martha Stewart. Things like that happen to me. So this is a painting that was commissioned by Christine Starkman at the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston. So it's been installed a couple times there that I know of. It's huge. I think it's 12 by 18 feet or so, and the two flanking wings of the painting of the triptych are celadon colors, and then the middle one is there are many periods or at least a few periods of ceramics that Koreans are well known for, and then the most recent was during the Yi Dynasty, and it was of whitish glazes, so I tried to emulate one of those for the middle panel. So this is that work with the difficult to pronounce title, which the director of my former gallery, Josie Brown, who's such a dear person and supporter, always pronounces Schenectady, which is a city in New York. It's simply a large painting made of many small panels of people's skin color done from observation. And so this is how it looked in the Whitney Biennial in 1993 when my career was just getting started. And there are 275 elements here. It's now at the National Gallery, and there are just under 400. So this is a little snapshot I took with my iPhone of the signage, of part of the signage at the National Gallery, because I have them put the people's names in the same order that in which the paintings are installed, which is alphabetical by first name. If anybody has any questions, by the way, just shout it out. I'm not looking up often enough to see your hand, but just speak up.
So going line on, as I counted, was about number, like, the fourth row.
Yeah, when I started it off, so the other thing to say about this is that you know, it's interesting making a huge painting incrementally, because I didn't really get to see the whole painting until it got installed in a show. And then, just as I was doing with that Rothko at the beginning of this lecture, I've looked at that painting. It hasn't been installed that many times. I've looked at that painting in the beginning and thought, what does it mean? Because It immediately came to mean something somewhat different than I had planned on. I simply was making thought I was making modernist paintings that looked like modernism, looked like modern art, but I was infusing them with a different kind of content, and so that was the main thought. But it just turned into this. It just happened to coincide with this moment of multiculturalism in the art world, and so it ended up becoming sort of a poster, almost literally, of the 93 Biennial. And so when I first saw this painting, it was strange. I didn't know exactly what it meant, and I felt closer to the signage than the painting, because I knew a lot of these people, and at the time that there were only 300, even the people that I didn't really know, I remembered, and so it felt closer and warmer, the text, because I couldn't really identify the people from their colors. And so I came to understand that painting by giving this lecture, essentially, because I would see it a lot and have to talk about it. This is a related painting that I made in 1993 also. It's called Emmet at 12 Months, and it's 25 colors on the body of my son when he was a year old. And so obviously they're mostly skin colors, but they're not limited to skin colors. For example, the one right in the middle is this thing called the so-called Mongolian blue spot, which a lot of people of color have just above their tailbone. It's kind of a birthmark that usually disappears after some months or a few years. And that's Emmett, who's now a freshman in college, but that's that's where, in our Williamsburg apartment with both of his feet in my classic, in one Air Jordan. Oh, and this is, so my youngest kid, I have three kids, and so Addie, the youngest one, who's in seventh grade now, when she was about in first grade or so, maybe kindergarten, first grade probably, she wrote this. I don't know if it was an art project or a writing project. So I sometimes explicate the artwork part, but I won't bore you with that. I'll just translate the text for you. Dear Dad, I love you. You be the, and I'll give her the benefit of the doubt here, nicest dad ever. I love you more than the whole world. So I really like this quotation because it's this kind of micro-macro thing where she says she loves me more than the whole world, but I certainly I'm part of the world. So it's kind of like people from Texas thinking that Texas is bigger than the United States or something like that. Anyway, I'd included this in my lecture for the reason that I just gave, I guess, and just like learning about synecdoche by having to talk about it through this process, I realized after a couple of times looking at this that that's not at all what this note says. It actually says, "Dear Dad, I love you. Could you be the nicest dad ever? I love you more than the whole world." And that "could" is so crucial because depending on, you know, the tone, it could be plaintiff or it could be astonishment. And I asked, she finally saw one of these lectures not too long ago, and afterwards she said, "Dad, I think I remember making that, and I think it's just because I wanted something from you, like a toy." So since January 7th, I think, 2001, I've been making these 14 by 14 inch paintings, not 14 by 14 feet, which that looks like. These little paintings this big of the sky, and then simply writing a few lines of kind of a journal entry. I don't really think of it as writing at all. This one says, "It was such a relief to talk to Barbara today after so long. Life would be intolerable without such good old friends. Ella is something is working on her first science fair project at home with Lisa. Emmett and Addie are with me at the studio playing with a little blue ball." So the bottom right always has the date and the time and the place. So this was made in my studio in Brooklyn, and if I were here over the weekend, I would have brought a panel with me to make the Sunday painting. There's a bunch of them in a show. And so Terry mentioned that these are, that I'm in a show in Santa Fe, and it has the show, I haven't been to the show, but it has the, it's a group show that has something to do with time. So they took the last 20 of these, I've made about 500 of them. They took the last 20 that I made, and then I'm FedExing them on Monday, a painting every week. Oh, this is a painting called Palms, parentheses, head over heart. I have this, I don't know if you can see from there, I have this really straight line on my palm. And Somebody treated me to this really fancy palm reading, a collector. This man came from India. He keeps an apartment in New York to do palm readings. And so we met him at his apartment. And he's telling me all these interesting things that seem to be true, but I'm a little bit skeptical because they're not very specific. And he doesn't really mention about this straight line. And so I finally ask him about it, and he says, oh yes, that. That means that the head and the heart line are fused. They're one. And then he proceeds to talk about it as if it's my head line. So I said, well, you said head and heart, but why is it just my head? And he said, that's because your head is dominant. And I gather that he must have known that from talking to me. And so I asked him, so how do you know that it's head and not heart? And he said, well, if you had a line like that and it were a heart line, then it would be one in billions and billions, like Jesus or the Buddha or something like that. So I said, okay, I get it. So that painting was made not that long ago. Well, actually, it's probably 7 or 8 years ago already. And this painting was made quite a while ago, and it's very small. That last painting was two panels that are 5 by 5 feet each, and these are tiny little actual size, also realist paintings of my first two kids' cowlicks. So they're made with egg tempera on traditional gesso with little tiny brushes. And that's what they looked like installed. They were in a show at Protech, where I used to show, and in New York, and there were only 4 paintings in the show. And this is part of a series of a painting or two from each place that I lived in my life. And so that the painting of my kids, the back of my kids' heads, was sort of a Brooklyn painting. And this is the painting that I came up with about Yale and New Haven, because I was an English major there, and I basically read a lot of 19th century poetry, and so this is sort of an illustration of Wordsworth's famous poem called I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud, which is about his memory of happening upon a field of daffodils when he was a child. So when I was a child, probably about the age that my daughter wrote that note, one day I was at school, and Miss Mashinsky said, my teacher said, Byron, my, that's a nice shirt. So then the next morning, when my mom was getting me dressed for school, I said, Mom, do you know that shirt that I wore yesterday? Yes. I have to wear that shirt again today. And she tells me that I insisted on wearing it for 3 weeks running. So this painting is about this big, and it's a kind of an olive green, which I remember fairly precisely, and then I can't remember whether the other stripe was navy or black. So of course I made 2 versions of the painting. So that was a Wallingford, Connecticut painting. I grew up in Wallingford, and this is another Wallingford, Connecticut painting. We lived in a pink house, which was kind of unusual. We didn't. My parents wouldn't paint their house pink, I don't think. It just was pink, and so I wanted to make a painting of this pink house, but I had an idea of what the color was, but I was curious what my sister and my parents thought it was. So I sent them this color chart and had them choose the color. So this is the one I got back from my sister, which has all sorts of extraneous information from which I derived the title, 46 Halsey Drive, Wallingford, Connecticut, 06492. So this is, you know, this is 20 years after she lived there. And she says in another part of the drawing that she could almost remember the phone number, but not quite. So I simply took a 4x8 sheet of construction grade plywood and took seven of their colors and rollered on the seven stripes and then repeated them. So then this is the La Jolla painting. I grew up in La Jolla also. I was born in La Jolla and then spent my teenage years there. The house, the apartment that we lived in, my parents and I, when I was born, was right on the beach. There's a museum in La Jolla that's a really beautiful contemporary art museum. And where I lived was a few doors down the hill from there, right along Coast Boulevard. And so it was a studio apartment that was kind of staff faculty housing for Scripps Clinic, where my dad worked. I don't think they get such nice housing now. Anyway, I knocked on the door, and at that time, I don't know, this is maybe 10 years ago, it was now the little building was the corporate headquarters for some hotel chain, and the woman that answered the door said I couldn't go up there, and I was very disappointed and started to leave, and she said, but if you come back in 20 minutes, the boss will be out to lunch and you can come up and do whatever you want. So I went up there and I measured the windows, and they were that size and they're 19 inches apart, and if you look out those windows, this is what you could see. So I didn't have the gumption to ask if I could paint from there, but I set up an easel outside near the beach. So this is the second. Wow, the museum photographer is so much better than me. This is a Bryce Marden painting that's in this museum's collection, and it's also a really beautiful painting. And it's interesting because I could have just, you know, I haven't made paintings that were trying to copy Rothko, but I'm interested in Rothko, and so some of my work is sort of in the spirit of Rothko. But I have actually made paintings that try to mimic these early Bryce Mardens, and I could really have just slipped this in there and talked about it as if it were mine. I'm not sure what the. I know this is. I don't think this is a Grove Group painting. I'm not sure what the subject matter is. Do you know?
The title is Ferdinand. I'm trying to remember. I think it is part of the series. Maybe somebody else knows.
Anyway, that's okay. So moving on, this is a 1984 Dodge Aries station wagon, which is about the nadir of American car design, I think, or maybe of industrial design period, or design for that matter. But when my really cool Volkswagen van was totaled, my dad very kindly gave me the family car, which at the age of 24 or whatever I was at the time, this is how ungrateful I was. I was kind of disappointed because it's such a dorky car. It's one of those few, speaking of material possessions, it's one of those few things that I ever owned that I really became attached to, just because I spent so much time in it and hauled a lot of stuff, and it was very reliable. And so this is a painting that I made in the style of Bryce Marden's early work from the exact same materials, because I used to drive a truck around with his as a job, moving art with a studio assistant of his. So I would ask how big the coffee can was, how long the palette knife was. And so the left panel in the middle are the two interior vinyl upholstery colors, and the one on the right is the exterior paint. So this painting actually is very similar to the painting here, I think. But it's about this really nice place in Williamsburg where, you know, I lived in Williamsburg in the late 80s and early 90s, when that whole scene was kind of getting started, and it had a really nice sense of community. And the locus of it was in my mind at this community pool, a public pool, just a very nice warm place. And so the painting that I just showed you has to do with the colors of the wall, the interior wall of the building, and the kind of color of that you sense when you're swimming, the tile of the pool and the water, looking through the water. I guess that's a decent segue for this. I often jumble my slides just to keep myself interested and awake. Because if I'm not awake, it'll be impossible for you guys to stay awake. So this is, I've only made a few sculptures, and this is one of them. This is a 120-gallon reef tank, saltwater tank, and there's really beautiful things inside, coral and beautiful fish. The bottom apparatus there is what keeps the water clean. So it's a normal saltwater tank, except that I laminated it with one-way mirror so that the fish can see you, but you can't see the fish. So what I meant in doing that was this kind of micro-macro thing always happens in my work. I didn't realize it till afterwards. Unlike Katie Patterson, who's very aware of that at the beginning of her career, I didn't know that I was doing that till quite recently. So I'm only at this time using it self-consciously. So the term synecdoche means a part standing for the whole. So I knew it when I was making that painting, but I didn't realize it was sort of running as a thread throughout my work. So what I was trying to do was make a sculpture through which you saw the rest of the show. So in a way, the sculpture stood for the rest of the exhibition, and then another kind of subsidiary meaning was that it, because the fish presumably could see us, but we couldn't see the fish, it effectively turned the gallery into a fish tank. So there's someone looking at a photograph that I made, and there's that palm painting, and then these paintings about a Van Gogh painting that I made. I'm not sure if I included those in my lecture today or not. And that's what you'd see if you were tall enough to peer over the top of the tank. And this is one of the those photographs, which I only made a few of these. And I thought I would continue making them, but the technology for making these things, this sort of thing, got so good that, I mean, I have an app on my iPhone that does this so much better than what I did, that it just really doesn't make sense anymore. But so back then, I took my point-and-shoot camera, stood in one spot, made sure that I included my feet, and I shot everything that I could. So it goes around 360 degrees every which way. So I kind of thought that this was a bit like my Sunday paintings, because it's me and the whole world, my whole world at that moment. So this is another one of those of my backyard. The last one was of Prospect Park near my house on the one snowy day. And this is just using a different kind of mapping strategy where I fill in the whole rectangle. Oh, I did include this. So when I was an infant, or actually through my whole childhood, I think through high school actually, there's a painting. Oh, I forgot what it's called, but it's a painting by Van Gogh, and it's in the Musée d'Orsay in Paris, and I've never been to Paris, so I've never seen this painting in person, but I had a really bad reproduction of it in my room my whole growing up, and so presumably this was my first encounter with art, and I found it in my mom's bathroom not too long ago. And I absconded with it, and I decided that I would make a bunch of paintings the size of the original painting, which I've never seen, but then the image would be details of that painting, but that I would work from reproductions, obviously. So these are different details. Oh, and the material is plasticine or modeling clay, which I used... because it's a kind of a kid's toy material as well as an art material. So there's a detail of just the sky, part of the sky in that painting. So I had a show 3 or 4 years ago in New York with about a half dozen paintings, and this was one. It sort of relates to that the series of paintings I just showed you. So this is a detail of one of Edward Hopper's last paintings called Sunlight in an Empty Room, something like that. It's from 1962, which is a year after I was born. And it's just a little horizontal slice of that painting, which is unusual because it's an interior with no figures. And it's 12 feet wide. So it's really enlarges the actual size. And I worked from a bad newspaper reproduction. This isn't that reproduction, but it's the one I worked from was actually worse. I don't know if I can explain why I was interested in working from bad reproductions at this point, but it had something to do with that experience of finding that original artwork. So in the same show, I had this Kirk Varnado's book of essays, the last essays he delivered, lectures, I mean, before he died, were collected in this book, and there's an illustration of a Robert Irwin piece, and Robert Irwin's a big hero of mine, and I especially love these disc paintings, but this reproduction is so bad that it to be virtually useless as something trying to represent the work, and I think that also even the dimensions were incorrect. So I made a painting at those incorrect dimensions, very faithful to the bad reproduction. And so the way that it ties in with the other, with the Hopper is that astonishingly, this painting, this work of Irwin's was made. Those works were made around 64 or so. So only a couple years after Hopper. So it's just crazy to me that Hopper and Irwin are working at the same time. So this was also in that show, which was sort of a show of stripe paintings, in a way, besides the Irwin. I ran across this anecdote about Delacroix, who was trying to paint yellow drapery and couldn't figure out how the shadow should be painted. So he decided that he would go to the Louvre to see how Rubens had managed it. And so he stepped outside his studio and hailed a cabriolet, which must be where we get the term cab. And I found out that those cabriolets were painted in chrome yellow, which is a lead-based yellow. So I decided that I would make... Oh, so I didn't even tell you the punchline. That's what happens when you give... I just gave this part. This I talked about this piece yesterday. So he walks out, hails the cabriolet, and sees the shadow under the carriage, and that's all the information he needed. So he pays the driver his fare, but then doesn't go to the museum. He just goes back into his studio to finish the painting. So I decided to make a painting about that story. And so I just was, you know, going to, of course, bring it, update it to be a New York taxi cab. And I did my usual thing, which was to go out with, you know, my watercolors and a tablet of paper and start making these studies of New York City cabs and their shadows on the roadbed. And they weren't working. They were really flat and boring. So I almost abandoned this painting and I didn't tell you the whole story about the Hopper painting, but I came very close to abandoning that one too. But I finally, so this is that kind of doubt experience that I always go through and anxiety that I always go through in my studio. So I finally decided, well, it's the part that I'm having trouble with is making the shadow seem like anything. So I decided that instead of depicting it, I would have a real shadow. So I made this yellow panel, and it casts a shadow on a gray rectangle, making the third middle stripe. So this is the other work that was in that show, and I think it appears to be a stripe painting with strangely chosen colors, and then why is the painting a stripe painting yet appears somewhat atmospheric? And it's because it's really a portrait of the UN building. And so the normal shot you see of the UN building is from, I think, from the East River when you see it in a coffee table book or something. And so you see that greenish curtain wall, glass curtain wall, broadly. The thin stripe on this painting in the actual building, if you look at it straight on, is actually the wide part of the building. But this is the New Yorker's view of the UN building, the soccer dad driving up the FDR twice a week or three times a week. That's what you'd see driving uptown, and this is what you'd see driving downtown at dusk. Then, so we've gotten to my last show, which I had... That was very recent. It was in November and December. So this is a painting that I showed a few years ago. This is how it works with me sometimes, more often than I'd like. I was working on this notion of the night sky in the city. No stars, reflected light, kind of about light pollution in a way, although not meaning for it to be really very political in any sense. Just realizing one day that the night sky in the city, though it's not the starry night, is still quite beautiful because the colors are so strange. So at first I tried to do that, make stain paintings, and a couple of them were acceptable, including this one. And I tried putting in a hint of architecture, and it was okay, but there was something a little bit too uncontrolled and a little bit too, I don't know how to articulate it, but maybe it's a weird thing to say, maybe once you see the paintings I came up with, but a little sentimental or corny. So eventually they became harder, a little bit more, but cooler, I guess, too. And so for a while I was getting rid of that architecture idea, and I just had these paintings that were just field. And the two people I ask to kind of vet my work in the beginning are Glenn Ligon and my wife, Lisa Siegel, who's also an artist. And they both came in, and when I was making those paintings without the border stripes, they said, okay, we understand what these, they separately said the same thing. I get what this is, what you see, but I don't think anyone else is going to get it. So that was really disappointing because I'd been working for 2 winters, more than a year. And my wife, as I was going on my second year of working on these paintings, my wife begged me to stop because she thought it was making me depressed. So I went back to this idea of giving a hint of architecture or shadow or something close to us. And then there was more to work with, and everybody responded really immediately. So these are 8 feet by 6 feet, approximately 8 feet. So these two slides are of Robert Mangold's paintings in the collection. I just saw one of these, so, but I was provided with 2 images, so I imagine there's another one in the collection, because I doubt that these are the same painting.
They are.
Mm-hmm. So,
that one's not accurate.
Yeah, this one isn't as close as this one is. So I don't know if it's from this series. I know that Mangold made this series of spaces between buildings, or spaces between architecture, and I didn't know that. I was told that by a curator, Molly Donovan, at the National Gallery. I didn't know that until after I started working on these paintings, so I became pretty interested in them. So how are we on time? Because I'm either finished or I have 3 more slides. Oh, is there a clock here? 6:55. It's 8:01. Oh, so I'm done then. I would be happy to take questions. I mean, if I have these 3 slides of sort of performances that I did. This was copying a David painting at the Met. And yeah, it looks nice from far away, but believe me. When I started the drawing the first day, a guard came up to me and said, "Hey, you're not painting the whole painting, are you?" And I said, "No, I'm just painting this detail here. Believe me, I couldn't paint this whole painting." And he said, "I've been working here over 25 years, and I've never seen someone paint part of the painting." Which I just, it was hard to believe. So this was Rick Rittier of Venezia, who's a conceptual artist who's pretty much my age and an artist that I greatly admire. He made a glass, a miniature version of Philip Johnson's famous glass house in Philip Johnson's old sculpture court at MoMA, and he then asked the curators to ask artists to teach kids art in that building, in that structure. So I brought oil paint to the Modern because they didn't ask me what I was going to do. I made non-toxic oil paint the night before and brought red, yellow, and blue in these big yogurt containers. And I had I divided the kids into red, yellow, and blue teams, and I had them paint directly on the glass. And I just had them start it without asking permission, and the guards looked at me like they were going to throttle me. And so, needless to say, the trip into the museum that they were supposed to take after this art class was canceled. But I think it was worth it because some of them will probably remember it for a long time. And this is also at the Met, Tom Finkel, Ad Reinhardt in the 60s said, he made many proclamations, and one of them was, there are no religious objects in the Fine Art Museum. And what he meant was, you know, for instance, when you go to the Kimball, when you go to the coat check, you know, those objects right there used to be religious objects, but Reinhardt thinks once you bring them into the Fine Art Museum, they lose all that meaning, and they acquire some other kind of meaning. So my friend Tom Finkelpearl and I went to test this out. So he went and prayed in front of an altarpiece, and then I did 108 prostrations in front of this big, beautiful mural that's a Buddhist scene. And so while I'm doing this, it takes about 20 minutes altogether, maybe a little more. Tom acts as if he doesn't know me and asks the guard, well, what's that guy doing over there? And the guard says, oh yeah, he's just, they come here, so he's just doing one of those ritual things that they do. And Tom says, really? Do people come here and do that kind of thing often? And the guy said, yeah, all the time. Sometimes they leave fruit and candy and we just have to clean up after them. So that's the real ending. I'm happy to answer any questions. But if you don't have any, that's fine also.
There is a question. I'll ask one that I would have thought of. Could you talk just a little bit about the role of looking in your work?
Wow. It's sort of the whole point in a way. I described, you know, looking at things really closely and trying to understand the color, as if that was getting at some sort of meaning about the thing. Also looking very intently because I at first didn't know much about color or how to make color because I don't have that much training in art. So I kind of learned how to mix color by mixing people's skin color. If anybody teaches color or painting, it's a great way to learn how to mix color. And so that's half of the answer to your question. And the other half is kind of what you observed just in the past hour. I'm obviously, as the palm reader said, I'm very much in my head, and I like to figure things out in advance. But it inevitably turns out that despite the fact that my work is very idea-oriented, I don't really understand it until much later, oftentimes. And I think that's what most artists must go through. Except certain artists who are very conceptual, I think. So there's that kind of looking that's observation of something in the world. And then there's an observation of my observation of it. Sounds very therapeutic in a way.
That's good. And well, and your those night sky paintings, how did looking
I just starting to make some more of them again, and I have a reminder to look at the sky every night. I just look at the sky in the city to see if there's anything interesting about it that particular night. And then I try to remember it for next time I'm in the studio. And I'll make these little studies and then make paintings from the studies. So, yeah, people ask me if I could do that, paint directly from observation at night. And I don't know how people do that, because I just don't know how my eyes would adjust from the lit paper or canvas to the dark sky. Doesn't seem that logical.
When you do these sky paintings, whether they're in the daytime or the nighttime, how do you choose the points in the sky? Do you use the same points?
No. That's a really good question. The night sky, I don't, in most cases, I don't choose a point. I'm just looking, and there's some sort of relationship that I'm trying to remember. And so it isn't exactly that, with the way the cornice of that building looks against the sky over there. It's just some sort of relationship, color relationship and value relationship, possibly. The Sunday paintings, on the other hand, they're small and they're in acrylic, and I have to get them done quickly because I have so much stuff going on, mostly because I have kids. And so if I can't get them done quickly, I would never be able to do this project. So I'm just telling you that by way of excusing myself in a way, because sometimes I'm just so happy that it's either completely cloudy or it's a nice blue sky. And sometimes if I'm in a rush and there are all these clouds, I'll sometimes look over there where it's mostly blue. But sometimes I have the whole afternoon, and I'll try to do something. I'll try to make a real study of it. And so I can zoom in or zoom out as I please. And it just varies. I don't have any rule for it, basically. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.